Hello and welcome to another episode of Know Your Media on KISU-FM. I am your host, Zach Gershberg, and I'm joined today by Dr. Neelam Sharma of the Communication Department, my colleague here at ISU. Neelam, great to see you.
Great to see you, Zach. Yeah. Thank you for having me on this show.
Yeah. And Dr. Neelam Sharma has a PhD from Colorado State University. She teaches a variety of journalism and media studies classes here at ISU, as do I. And I wanted to bring you on today, Neelam, because while we are bombarded here in February 2020 with the impeachment trial of former President Trump over incitement to insurrection, and that's going on as we speak, there has been news around the world about the fate of democracy. In the previous weeks, there was a coup in Myanmar that the military overthrew the democratic government there. But then also there was a recent piece in The Atlantic magazine about developments in India, where you happen to be from. But it's a little bit different than a coup because the prime minister, Narendra Modi, had been reelected in 2019, but we certainly can kind of lump him in to the populists like Donald Trump, Viktor Orban of Hungary, Philippe Duterte of the Philippines, and others around the world. And so I'm just curious to get your sense on a certain the media crackdowns that are going on right now. And I think we can have a discussion about the implications for freedom of press and democracy more generally.
Thank you for this great introduction, because a lot is going on in the world's largest democracy, as we like to describe yes. India, because it has more than 1.3 billion people. And we have a lot of events that had happened in the world, especially the January 6th insurrection in the US, and then the January 26th Republic Day protests and violence in India. And these can be clubbed together and seen within the broader context of what is going on in democratic countries. What is the media's role here? And what are populist leaders, whether elected just once or re-elected, are trying to act in a very authoritarian way and trying to control the media and its narrative. So yes, we saw that in India. And what I want to really mention here is that Modi, it is his second term as a prime minister. And he won with a bigger margin in 2019 than the number of seats that he won in 2015 when he was first elected. So he's a career politician. He isn't a chance politician. He has a background of a mainstream politician. But then he also has an image of being very close to right wing. He's a right wing Hindu leader. He's authoritarian. And then he is also, and he doesn't like criticism. And that is what we are seeing in India right now. And now when you throw social media and free speech into the mix of things, it is a pretty complicated world out there. So right. His 2019 re-election, in fact, has met with a lot of protests in one way or the other. So we are seeing a continuous protesting sure. on different issues and since he's been re-elected.
And so it's really interesting. Again, we're joined today by Dr. Neelam Sharma, my colleague in the Communication, Media, and Persuasion Department at ISU. And Neelam, you were a political reporter for some time in India. And, you know, the recent news after the Republic Day protests, the Indian government has led a crackdown against the Caravan magazine, against Twitter. Over the last year and a half, there's been the suspension of autonomy in the state of Kashmir. And I guess I'm curious, all democracies tend to be fraught with free speech and free press. I'm curious, do you think there's a definitive line that's been crossed since you were practicing journalism as a reporter in India and what's going on now?
I think many people sense this change. especially since the Modi government has been elected in 2014, and more so in 2019, because it's a complete control of power. They are not in a coalition as we were in the previous governments. So you have various compulsions, and it's a multi-party coalition. This is a party which has a very high number of seats. So in Indian democracy, you need more than 50% seats to be elected in power, and they have much more than that. So there's no threat to the stability of the Modi government at center, which is a good thing and a bad thing. It's a good thing because, of course, it's a stable country. The government is not going to go anywhere for the next 3+ years. But then it also gives government a complete control. So what we're seeing, Modi 2.0, as some people like to describe in 2019, the government, it is very clear about its agenda, that it has to push certain things that weren't done. It has to push certain things that will make people unhappy, certain sections, especially, for example, Muslims. It has to push for more reforms. We call reforms as more corporatization. So big businesses gaining, that is what we're seeing here. And this government doesn't like to be criticized by anybody, including media and activists. So yes, the media, mainstream media, what we see is that social media is polarized, but so is mainstream media.
Yeah, we find ourselves, it seems, in such an odd situation because there are reports out of India that the government has gotten Twitter to shut down certain activist accounts, certain media accounts. And we're experiencing almost the inverse because after the 1/6 insurrection here in the United States Capitol, we do know Twitter and Facebook took steps to remove President Trump and other insurrectionists from their platforms. And so, in the name of preserving democracy, and granted, Facebook and Twitter are American companies, but they have an international scope. But it seems as though almost that these social media companies are willing to play ball with these anti-democratic figures elsewhere in the world. And that seems like kind of a bizarre and inconsistent move. And I know, Neelam, you're also a social media researcher, so this must be kind of a wild time for you at this point.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I certainly agree with you. I was reading the New York Times yesterday, and there's an article that Twitter has agreed to block more than 500 accounts that were criticizing Modi.
Do you think it's something where Twitter just wants access to the Indian market? You know, it's a country of over 1 billion people. And even though they took a step to try to maybe maintain democracy in the United States after 1/6, they're showing a totally different visage when it comes to India. If these are I mean, these are activists in a democracy that supposedly has the rights to free expression.
Definitely, this is a very valid point, and people are indeed talking about it, especially after yesterday's Twitter's action, where it did block 500. Government wanted more than 1,000 accounts blocked, but they did block 500. What the Indian government is saying is that you have to abide by the local laws, and the local law says that if the government orders you to shut something, you have to, otherwise your staff will be jailed for 7 years. Now, this is a little different from how these companies are dealt with in the US, right? You have more freedom there. Now, but there is certainly a criticism there. Twitter is definitely being criticized. It is seen as towing Modi's line at present by blocking. And we saw something similar with Facebook. And India is Facebook's largest market in the world. And India is Twitter's third largest market in the world right now. So these are big markets. These companies have a lot of vested interest. And we saw in October 2020 that the head of Facebook was removed after international pressure because she was deemed to be promoting right-wing posts. Or in other words, I can say that she refused, or the company refused, to delete some very hate content.
Okay.
posted by the right-wing people. So we see this right-wing and left-wing and the government's interference in both Facebook and Twitter. Of course, it's very clear that attempts are being made to curtail speech.
The difference here is even when Twitter did remove then President Trump after January 6th, it wasn't at the behest of the American government. It was of their own volition. The United States government is not going to tell these social media companies and what to do. And there is some discussion over Section 230, which grants online companies legal immunity, basically from libel cases. But that's sort of a different issue. But that is kind of interesting. And I do want to quote from this article by Vidya Krishnan from The Atlantic magazine, where he writes, quote, "The war on truth in India is very much like the war on truth in the United States. And since 2015, 2016, at the start of kind of the Trump campaign for presidency, we've heard a lot of these terms of disinformation and misinformation." And I'm just curious, do you think that do you think that's an accurate statement? I mean, are we seeing really information wars going on in both countries at this point?
Oh, certainly. And you also must factor in that India has a internet penetration is 50%. So of course, there are it's a big country with a huge population, but it is still a country where internet access is not with everybody.
Okay.
And even then, there is misinformation. That's a real problem that emerged as a big major problem in 2019 elections. We have seen a lot of political parties funding a lot of money in these information or misinformation campaigns targeted at certain communities with a certain agenda. So definitely this is a big concern. And yes, it is an information or a misinformation war going on. And I think it's a problem where everybody wants to control something.
You mentioned the election campaign of 2019, where Modi was re-elected. If I recall correctly, some of the concerns over misinformation were often facilitated through WhatsApp, a cell phone app, which happens to be owned by Facebook. And as part of an ongoing antitrust case from the American Department of Justice, and so WhatsApp has is kind of a free text messaging service that Facebook owns, but maybe not a lot of Americans know what that is. But it's played a big role in Brazilian elections, as well as India. So is that one of the maybe differences within the communication environment there in India?
Yeah, absolutely. WhatsApp
Okay.
played a big role. I would say a more negative role than a positive role.
Okay.
And WhatsApp penetration in India is extremely high. A common man doesn't perhaps understand that this is owned by the same Facebook company.
Right.
It is a completely different entity. There is a certain demographic that is always on WhatsApp, so it's very easy to reach them on that platform. And India is WhatsApp's biggest market. So India is Facebook's biggest market as well as WhatsApp. So imagine how much control Mark Zuckerberg has on
Right.
that.
Well,
So it is, so yeah, it did play. It's a very much a part of political campaign,
sure.
digital political campaign.
It's
And yes, misinformation. So I actually recently did a study about digital propaganda misinformation in India's
Oh.
election.
Okay.
In 2019, and the attempt there is to derail the agenda set by the mainstream media, so have a parallel agenda and create a doubt among people's mind as to what is truth. Should you
Wow.
believe a WhatsApp message or should you believe the mainstream media? So I think the mainstream media's credibility and people's trust in it is it's going to be a big concern in the coming years in these countries.
Okay. Thank you. And again, we're talking with Dr. Neelam Sharma from here at ISU. You were just speaking about this study that you've done on misinformation in the 2019 Indian election. And there's a couple of points I think that leap out to me. One is that There was some thought that text messaging might play a role in the American election of 2020, but that didn't really seem to pan out. And that's really these long text message chains on WhatsApp seems to be at the center of some research, it seems, in India as well as Brazil. But then the other thing I thought what you said that was so interesting, and I want our audience to hear this, and I want to just spotlight this for a second here, is that misinformation is not about, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, misinformation is not about actually trying to convince you of a conspiracy theory, maybe like QAnon, as we've seen in the United States, but it's getting you to doubt everything, any sort of institutional trust, whether it's government or the media, as it were. Do I have that right as you're trying to define it?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are two things going on here. One is, of course, misinformation where you have wrong information, but it's also a parallel agenda setting.
Okay.
That, you know, where you're doubting mainstream media. And that is kind of what I would say, all these radical elements have always existed in society. So it's not something new.
Right.
Especially in very diverse countries, conspiracy theories aren't new. You always have an audience for these kind of things.
Right.
But of course, with digital technology and with so much of production of messages that's going on, a common user is certainly confused. And who benefits from this confusion?
Okay.
So it's an agenda there, and we did see that in 2019. Now all the political campaigns in India, especially, are using that very heavily, where they are pumping in a lot of money in digital propaganda, digital campaigning.
Right.
So that's there.
And so is there a path? I mean, I guess this is just like the notion of truth in the United States or India, I guess. Is there any sort of hope for traditional media sources or traditional journalistic reporting, given the widespread use of digital technologies and the wild spread of misinformation? Is there any way to walk this back, or is just it's open and out there and there's not much we can do?
I think whether it's the US or whether it's India, we need a very strong independent media. And I think that is what everyone agrees, and that is what I think is the solution. We actually rather need a very strong, very independent media. So while one way of looking at this whole situation is, for example, Modi government's crackdown on certain media houses in country, so they have been very selective with this. So we cannot, and we shouldn't present a picture that free speech is under a major threat in India, or media is, you know, the government is after media. The government is after certain media outlets,
right,
who have been relentless in Modi's criticism. So that distinction is also needs to be made very clear. So the media in India is still free. The independent press still functions. But it's a matter of now, what do we see in future? What should be the role? I think in the future, in the coming years, and I've been talking to journalists, one of my studies is about talking to journalists, journalist interviews, and what they should be doing. And everybody is of an opinion that the media will emerge stronger. The independent media will emerge stronger, because when something is being attacked, something will come out of it. So India is very vibrant. Indian media is vibrant. So yes, the media is going to react. So we will see a lot of tussle between government and media. We now see a lot of pro-government media, mainstream media, which is very vocal, which is saying things in favor of Modi, in favor of the government. They have their own economic compulsions as well, because media is a commercial entity. And but at the same time, we also see that there is a very vocal criticism of Modi government. So now the outcome of that has to be something that is a combination of this. So we should see a media that is very vocal, which doesn't shy away from criticizing the government. We will probably see an emergence of very strong voices. And I would visualize a future for media. I think people are very interested in having a strong media because of there's so much polarization right now. Another big problem is lack of trust in mainstream media, which is again a big problem for the media industry to solve.
That
They really
seems
need to bring in good
right.
journalism to survive because economics won't make sense if your product is banned.
Sure. I think one thing that I'm curious about, especially considering the United States and India are two of the biggest democracies in the world, is that level of decentralization. So I know very early on in the history of the United States, Congress and the Postal Service subsidized local newspapers because the idea was to have a decentralized media network. And that was really, I think, vibrant until the last sort of 30, 40 years or so, as newspaper chains and, a declining lack of trust, but then also the rise of the big cable networks, as well as we've seen the New York Times and the Washington Post emerge. But that has sort of hurt localized media sources. And I'm just curious. I mean, India is just such a wonderfully diverse country, and I mean, there are different languages, and the South is very different from the North, which is different from other areas. And so I'm just sort of curious, is there a decentralized element to Indian media away from the big metropolitan centers like a New Delhi and a Mumbai?
Yeah, that's a good question. We also have to, there are a few things about Indian media that we really need to understand because it's a very different market. It's a multilingual
Right.
media. So we have 22 languages, and there are some bigger and smaller publications in all the languages. So when we look at the English press and we say regional or vernacular press, the readership of regional language press surpasses English press by a lot, big numbers.
Sure.
So in India, the readership of non-English media is a lot bigger. So there is a systematic decentralization because of linguistic
Sure.
differences in any case. But we also see, but what we have seen since what we call liberalization of the economy in 1990s, what we have seen is we have seen a few things here. We have seen change in the structure of ownership, so there is consolidation, as we have seen in the US. So it's
Right.
the big few big players who dominate the market. It comes with its own kind of problems.
Sure.
Then we also have the foreign investment that the government has allowed in print media and electronic media. So there is international collaborations as well. So CNN has presence in India through its sister channel. So India is a very multi-layered, complex media market. But
As we
so
might
which has
expect.
a different language press.
Right.
So
Okay.
in the US, we mostly see English language, and then
Sure.
we see the local and the national, and then we see big players and small players. In
Yeah.
India, we see language presses
Okay.
as well, which have vast leadership. So what has been a problem in the recent years is consolidation and also commercialization.
Yeah.
So I think it is similar to the US, and these two things also bring in a lot of problems.
It's really funny you bring that up because that's something I'm asked all the time by students and people I meet. You teach media, everyone wants to talk to you about bias and fake news. But in some ways, those of us who study media are really interested in looking at ownership issues and consolidation issues. And that used to be a huge emphasis, not just in terms of government policies here in the United States, but also until the 1990s in India, and that really changed in the United States. One of the most important acts of legislation, not about bias or anything else, was the 1996 Telecommunications Act. And this is where Section 230 comes out of, and all of these different elements. But it's this this legislation that, and it was bipartisan too. but that's such an interesting, I think, point you make up. And I guess in terms of, since we both teach journalism and media courses here, and I see, I'm just curious, given that, you know, we're doing so during a time where there's just such a considerable mistrust of the mainstream press. We don't often talk about this, but how, maybe for our listeners here in our community, like, I mean, how do you meet that kind of resistance?
That's an interesting question. I don't think any journalism professor would have an answer for that, because these are very interesting times. I have a friend in Colorado, of course. I was in Colorado before coming here, and she told me that they are seeing a huge enrollment in their journalism classes.
Oh, okay.
Because people are very interested. Which I was very, I mean, I found this very interesting that they were having a huge, I mean, it's the highest ever enrollment in their journalism classes.
Wow.
Because people were very concerned and wanted to become journalists, or especially after what they've seen and, you know, what a bad press can do to a country. So I don't know what to expect. I think we can look at the bright side and we can say that, okay, people might have learned something in the last 4 or 5 years, and they will actually look for good media, or at least they will appreciate good media, or probably they will know what to trust. The flip side of that is that it may not happen,
right?
And that's a danger. But what should you be teaching journalism students? I think you really need to be teaching journalism students that a good objective product will sell, no matter where you are.
What's so interesting about this moment, or the moment we've been having in some ways for the last decade or so, is that we have more media than ever before. But in some ways, we have less and less journalism as we traditionally understand that. And so I loved how you used that word vibrant to consider, like, the Indian media to be vibrant. And I think, knowing, you know, a little bit about the history of American media, I would use a similar term. And I think it's important that we not just have those sort of echo chambers that sometimes are created. But I also think for the future of a free press, you know, making sure that for democracies themselves, that they don't crack down and imprison reporters and editors is kind of important. And so I hope that development definitely goes away.
And especially when we are teaching students about journalism, we have to be more optimistic about the future of journalism.
Right.
And I was actually reading one paper, an academic paper on populist leaders and their relationship with mainstream media. People are trying to theorize that. This is very interesting, because the leaders have a very problematic relationship with mainstream media. So we have to be aware of that. They like to use social media, so that's a big tool. They also like to come back to mainstream media to validate things. Mm-hmm. And that's where mainstream media can, the free press can contribute.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Neelam, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed. I hope I made sense. And it's a very complicated topic. A lot is going on. We can spend 7 days on this topic. So thank you.
So you've been listening to Know Your Media on KISU FM. I'm Zach Gershberg, your host, and I want to thank again Dr. Neelam Sharma for joining us today. We'll see you next month on Know Your Media.